Good morning, everybody. I'm Kwanda Karegi from STFC, from the eScience department at STFC. I'm going to talk to you today about some of the projects and initiatives we've got going in STFC, and in particular, I'm going to focus on one. My talk's entitled Policy and Practice. I'm going to do the practice first, and then to try and motivate the policy. And in fact, I suspect that I've probably got too much material for the talk, so I'll be skating over the policy and giving you some references there, probably rather than going into detail. So first I'm going to tell you a little bit about STFC, what we do, and I'm even going to touch on, I think quite bravely, why we do it. Then I'm going to give you an example project about a practice, what we're really doing in managing data and archiving data in one particular project, notably not ODE, PARS in the EU, DATSCAPE or CIDIPES, which are all projects that we're involved in, which will be presented tomorrow. And then I talk about some relatively new principles on data policy that have come out from RCUK, which is the body at over the seven research councils which fund research in the UK. So to begin with, what is STFC? It's one of the funding bodies in the UK. It's one of the research councils. And we fund research in many disciplines, in particular particle physics, astronomy, and nuclear physics. And we also run some very large facilities which are used in a whole variety of different disciplines. For example, this here, which this aerial photograph's a little bit old. This is now finished. This is the ISIS facility, which is a neutron source where we can fire neutrons at something to find out the structure of the material. This is the diamond synchrotron, again, an X-ray light source which can be used to study materials. And just to give you a feel for the scale, that's 250 meters across the circumference of that building. In the center there, a smaller facility, but equally important, is the central laser facility where some intensely high-powered lasers, which give unbelievably short pulses of very, very high energy, which basically blow material to little bits so that we can study the nature of the materials. Over here, because I'm from the computing side, that was our old computing laboratory there, and that green field there is no longer a green field. That is where we are housed at the moment with a very modern high-tech machine room and some offices for the scientific computing infrastructure and IT people. We also have a laboratory in the northwest of England at Daresbury with similar remit, and we fund the UK involvement in many international facilities. That's the ESRF, the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, rather similar to Diamond in RAL, but on a European scale, and the ILL, reactor-based neutron source, also in Grenoble in France, where the UK component of that. We also fund astronomy, so I'm trying to get an increasing scale here, so I picked a radio telescope. This is the Square Kilometre Array, which is, as it says on the tin, going to be built and is a square kilometre in size. We also fund optical telescopes, of course, and the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, where that pipe in the picture there, I think, is 20-something kilometres long. So these are very large-scale facilities, and that is really the heart of what STFC does. What's the kind of science we do? Well, here in the diagram, you'll see that it covers all sorts of different disciplines, and I'll pick just a few. But first, I'll tell you a little bit about typically what happens at the facilities at Rutherford. So we have a large-scale facility, and there is a generator of some sort of particle. This is the Target Station 2 at ISIS, which protons are fired into it, and it showers neutrons out, which are then used to penetrate and look at the structure of the materials. You put something in front of that neutron source. This is an aircraft wing, a piece of an aircraft wing that is being put in front of there. And then from the way the neutrons behave as they pass through the wing, you can work out whatever it is you're trying to work out, in this case, the strain in the wing. And here I've got a whole bunch of different slides about the different kinds of science, and there's too many of them to go into in detail. But for example, this one is about storing hydrogen in a very compact way so that you can have efficient hydrogen-based vehicles. This is about studying the way that particles float around in muddy water, This is about looking at the way that a spin affects the magnetic properties of materials that are used in hard disks and other electronic components. That's the wing that I've already told you about. This is about studying how a particular kind of glass can be used to help bones grow by looking at the action on the surface. And there are very many of these. I won't go into them all. This one I like in particular because that crude oil on the right is rather more solid than you imagine oil might normally be. And many others which I won't go into. So we really do cover a whole broad range of different scientific disciplines. If some of you were at the APA conference 4 years ago, you would have heard Keith Jeffrey give a talk about building tomorrow's infrastructure for science, and that is the state that Diamond Synchrotron was in at the time. That's now built, and what I'm going to let you catch up with now is the state of the digital infrastructure as well. So I'll begin with some of the same diagrams that Keith put forward. The first is the why we do it. We're in the business of building new knowledge. The body of knowledge that mankind or humankind has created is there in the center of the diagram. And on the right-hand side, if I can find out which one is the laser. Oops. Sorry about that. No, I'll have to click through again. Sorry. Sorry about that. On the right-hand side of this diagram is the scientific life cycle, and I know some of the other speakers will probably be giving us scientific life cycles as well. We see a lot of these life cycles. And what we're doing is building up a body of knowledge which is then used by others for other purposes, and for example, by the government to increase competitiveness and quality of life for citizens. Looking at that life cycle in the right-hand one, in a little bit more detail, you can actually break it up into different things. Firstly, the body of knowledge is not just a single body of knowledge. There are lots of different disciplines, lots of data all over the globe, as was described earlier. And what we do with that typically is we create some data and put it somewhere, and then we want to keep it for a while, and then we want to be able to access it later. And all of that requires an underpinning e-infrastructure, a computing infrastructure, such as networking, storage, computing, and various services built on top of that. Now, the reason I've laid this out in this particular way is because I want to make a point here that the researcher is really only interested in this horizontal dimension here. They want to put data somewhere and get it again later. And really, they would very much like not to have to worry about the vertical dimension. All the computing infrastructure, all the catalogs and indexing and making that available. So our job, from the science perspective and perhaps for some of the others in the room as well, if we do it successfully, we'll make ourselves invisible. It will make that blue part disappear and allow researchers just to create and access data without worrying about the infrastructure. So here's another diagram. I call it the seven C's. The life cycle presented a different way, and of course you can start anywhere you like, but let's start up here, where some researchers get together to form a collaboration and design an experiment. They'll run some experiment and create some data. Of course, that could be actually making an experiment, or it could be observational. And they create some data and then put it somewhere, and then you typically do some computation on that data. You want to be able to keep it so that you can revisit that computation later. And then, not always the case, but often the case, that you build some sort of collection from the data. This is a collection in the sense that the libraries or information scientists might use. This is putting together different kinds of data so that the sum of the parts is greater than the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And then we'll communicate the results of that, perhaps through the journals, perhaps we'll just directly communicate the data, and that in itself creates new collaborations, and so the cycle goes around and around. So now I'm going to tell you some of the activities we do for each of those seven Cs. So on the creation side, there's an example there of one of the large magnets at CERN, but there are many different types of detector in many different types of facilities that we have. And certainly at Rutherford, with the facilities based there, That is the neutron and the synchrotron source there. What we've been focusing in recent years is about getting that early stage sorted out, so that when a user puts in information into a research proposal and then turns up sometime later to run their experiment, the information that was in the research proposal is automatically propagated through. They don't have to re-enter that information. Most importantly, perhaps, their own name and the information about themselves is carried through, information about the experiment they're trying to do, what sample it is they're investigating, etc. And also, when the data acquisition comes, that data has to be put somewhere and tagged in one way or another, either by linking it or by literally adding metadata to the information about the experiment and about the people doing it. And getting this part sorted out is relatively straightforward from a technological point of view, but it's absolutely essential if that data is going to be usable in the future. Because one thing that we've found that people turning up to run an experiment do not want to put in their name, their affiliation, their sample, and all the other stuff about the parameters. Some of it they don't even know. Some of it is parameters about the instrument, which our people, the instrument scientists, are setting up for them to do their experiment. And so we've put a lot of focus in recent years on trying to get that as automated as possible. And that metadata put in at one stage of the cycle is automatically carried through the life cycle and available at all stages. It's absolutely essential. So with the laser facility, for example, some of the older facilities fired one laser shot every 20 minutes. The new ones are starting to talk about hertz and kilohertz and even moving in some other fields, megahertz and gigahertz of collection rates. So if we're taking a photograph at a billion times a second, we don't want to have to annotate it individually with metadata, of course. Talking about capacity, so this is a little graph about what we've been doing over roughly the last 15 years, the amount of capacity, and we've already heard about the increase in the amount of data out there from Keith today. For us, over some 14 years or so, we've moved from roughly, what's the units here? It's kilobytes, I think, to, it must be megabytes up to 10 petabytes. If you look at that, we've gone 1,000 times in 13 years, which gives us a Moore's law of 1.3. That is, we double the capacity every 1.3 years. And now we know that the availability of the disks and the like has a Moore's law of its own, somewhere between 1.5 and 2 years. So it doesn't seem that much more. But if you actually compare the Moore's law 1.3 years to 1.5 or 2 years, it actually turns out that we've got probably 10 times more data now than if we just had Moore's law applying at a 2-year level. So that little bit of difference on how quickly you double your data over years does increase the scale of operations very significantly. Some of our biggest holdings are from the Large Hadron Collider experiments at CERN's and atmospheric and environmental data that's held in a hierarchical storage management system. Just to talk a little bit about computation now, there's lots of different perspectives here. One type of computation is a fitting of experimental data to some theoretical model. The model is computed using some hefty computing equipment, and also the fitting of the data to the model requires some high-powered computing. In order to make that equipment available, some of that is farmed out on the grid. So as Salvatore was saying, you may not know where the computer running your compute is. Over here is a point that says the computation is not only the obvious part about whatever it is you need to do to analyze the data you've collected about your sample. There's also a lot of computation going on just to see how the machine itself is developing. So here we have the diagnostic data about the laser itself. That also needs high-powered computation just to see and tune the instrument to peak performance. And over here, a more theoretical application is also required to build the models that we then fit the data to. Moving on to curation, the picture is of our storage robot, which has capacity for 20 petabytes, so enough for another year and a half or so if we're doubling the storage every year, 1.3 years. And it's not just the sheer volume of storage, it's the number of files. So here, this just shows an example. We've got all the files that were collected on the ISIS neutron source over the last 25 years. It amounts to some 3 million files. Diamond had been running, this is a slightly old slide, it's been running a bit more than 2.5 years now, but at the when it had been running for 2.5 years, we already had 11 million files. So it's the number of files which actually leads us to a data management problem just as much as the volume of data. And a little bit on the number of stores, different applications there, very varied, all using the same infrastructure. I didn't notice what time I started. What time have I got until?
You've got 5 minutes.
Only 5 minutes left, right. That's going to be a challenge. The collection stage is putting things together, having a metadata in an appropriate archive. So we've got a metadata catalog, ICAT, which captures parts from those parts of the life cycle pretty well, but doesn't yet have a full record of the later parts. Those are what we're working on. Communication, I will just say that obviously the web has changed everything. We do everything through the web in our personal lives, our domestic lives at home. So we expect to be able to do the same thing with our professional lives in science. And that really does mean that the users come with very, very high expectations about the availability of services over the internet. Collaboration, I'll skip because I'll talk about that in a minute. So the example project I want to talk to you about is PanData, and it fits in this picture here where you'll see a UDAP, which will be talked about tomorrow, and SciDIP, which is an APA project, and PanData is one there. It's about putting in place a common infrastructure or an interoperable infrastructure across the facilities that STFC run with similar organizations across Europe. So here there are 10 other or 9 other organizations similar to STFC across Europe, which we want to share an infrastructure. And 2 new ones joining now, makes 13. Those together, the instruments on those facilities are used by 30,000 scientists per year, at least. So as you see, that's a very significant community. These are people coming and visiting the facilities, doing their experiment, and then moving on. So it's a very significant community that we're trying to see. And we've also found that about 20% of those are using more than one facility. So they will have benefit if they can share the infrastructure across the two. When they come to a new facility, they will feel at home, find the same infrastructure there so that they can be more efficient. So this is about what we have the situation as was, which is there was a different e-infrastructure at each of the different facilities. What we're trying to do is put in place common technologies across those so that they can all talk to each other, so that we can get federated or aggregated catalogs of data and metadata, so that they have a single user experience as they visit any one of the facilities. The driver behind this, we're all used to what we get from Google Maps now, which puts together information from a satellite image with a road image, and in our field, if we can put together the data that's collected at different types of instruments, then you can get a better quality analysis of the structure of the material you're looking at. The PanData project, we focused on 5 areas of standardization in a support action that is just finishing now, about policy areas of data policy, how to exchange user information, so there's a standardization activities there, about scientific data formats, and about data analysis software. This was a standardization activity primarily, which are here. The point I want to make is that actually there's a lot of work in developing the policy at the front end so that you can implement technical solutions. It's no good trying to implement common technical solutions if you haven't got a common policy framework in which to build. We're finishing that project now. We're starting a new project which is building on those things. You want me to finish in 1 minute? I've got 6 minutes left then.
No, that says
He said 14. Okay, so we're putting the catalogs of users and data into service, and we're building provenance, which is something I want to talk about, and preservation services as well. I won't mention this. It's really going to be released. So finishing here, the infrastructure, there is quite a lot of work going on at European level and global level about having common infrastructure there, which we call the e-infrastructure. Up here, we're talking about ICAT and the metadata catalogs. Over here, we're talking about various portals into that information. Over here, what have we got? We've got information feeding in from the users, from the data acquisition systems, and now the new part is feeding in from the data analysis systems so that we can track which file was generated from which file by which software during the analysis process, and put all those together, and we get provenance research from creation to access. So that's the end of that. I shall skip the data policy principles. I'll give you a reference at the end. I think this is quite an important piece of work that's been set up in the UK, and I do encourage you to go and look at those. I think there's an awful lot of important principles there that we have to agree as a community are the right principles if we're going to put in place any common infrastructures. And just a final thought then, looking at these seven C's again, I think the work of the APA and many access permanent, many sort of curation projects has been in that area there. It's about collecting the data in the right way so that you can access it later. What we're trying to do now, the new part that we're trying to add to that in some of the projects at SDSC is the computation down here so that we can actually track the from the publication through to the published data, through the computation stages, as I said, including which software, which version of which software was used to derive which file from which file, all the way back to raw data. And the last thing, which we're not yet doing, but as Javier brought it up this morning, was what about the part at the top of the life cycle? What about the means of communication that we're using? This is not just the literature anymore. There's a whole load of plethora of different social network type ways that communication happens to go from the results of one project into the proposal for the next. And so what are we doing about tracking that and preserving that? So that's me finished. Thank you. Those are two references.